button.
Welcome, and thank you all for standing by. At this time, I would like to inform all participants that your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. I would also like to inform you today's call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Secretary Merrill. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. It's nice to see you or not see you or whatever we are at this time. I feel like these calls are working very well. This is an important partnership, and it's such a good way for us to let you know what's going on from our office. And I know many of you are calling in and emailing in with questions for Ted and the rest of the crew. So I'm glad this is working. We've decided that rather than have one every week at the same time, that we need to kind of update you as things happen. So I think from now on we're going to do more of an update when important things happen, not necessarily always on the same day of the week. So this week, two things have happened that I think are important for you to know about. One of them is that there was an executive order from the governor about petitioning candidates. There was a lot of discussion about exactly how people are going to be able to petition onto the ballot under these circumstances, and it was in a lot of the news reports. He did come out with an executive order, and it is also still in court with the Libertarian candidate for the general election. So there's a lot going on in that world, and I'm going to let Ted Bromley tell you the details of how that involves you or might involve you. And the second thing that we did this week is we issued an opinion from our office defining what we meant by sickness in the statute. You know, this is one step along the road of trying to figure out how to advise voters on how they're going to be able to vote during the primary election. We're still not, you know, there with the general election because that's still quite a ways off, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what the world looks like in November. But for now, we thought it was very important to give an indication to voters what the meaning of the word sickness or illness is in the statute. So it will be, or maybe already is, posted on our website. Sorry, but I'll let Ted tell you the details on that as well. And hopefully that'll bring some clarification to a situation that really has just never confronted us before. So as you all know, we do have our plan and process. And so now I'm going to turn this over to Scott Bates, my deputy, and thank all of you again for this very important partnership. I think working together, it's going to make this so much better for this primary election coming up. So thank you very much. Okay, Scott, take it away.
Well, thanks very much, Madam Secretary. And just two points from me in particular that touch on everybody on this call. First is for all of you to work on getting a plan together, your Safe Polls plan, which is on our website of what that's about, and I believe Ted has sent out to all of you the requirements of that. Why is that important? Well, it's important because it helps us talk through with you the locations you'll have for polling sites, the staffing levels, and also talking through with your local poll workers and moderators if they're willing to work in August, and also reviewing your emergency plan and getting that to us. Once you've done that, it unlocks some real value for you because Secretary Merrill is going to be purchasing, they call it PPE, the personal protection equipment, so that you and your poll workers and moderators can operate in the pandemic environment and do so safely. So we can do that, and along with a few other things that we can do, which is like cleaning the polling sites and other things. But that can only really be done when you've turned in that plan to us. And that can be a phone call to us and talking it through. It's not a difficult process at all, but we do want to get those resources to you. And the second thing along those lines is that the Connecticut National Guard will be doing a cyber security assessment for each of your town's election infrastructure for cybersecurity. Well, that just means making sure that you've got the right protections on your computer equipment, and the Guard is there to help. They are there to work with you to assess your own situation, and then that can again help us target the right kind of help for you to make sure that cyber systems for you are strong as well. And I think what cybersecurity has shown us, and I have to say a pandemic has shown us, is that everything is interconnected, that all of us are only as strong as the weakest link, and so we all have to pull each other up together. That's definitely the case in cybersecurity. It's definitely the case in society operating in a pandemic. So please work with us to make sure you check in and on both of those scores. And so in particular, Ted and his team are there for you all the time. I was about to say 24/7. It just feels like that. But they're not there 24/7, but they're thinking about it all the time. But we have augmented our staff. We have more people coming on board. That's because of the resources of the federal government, and that's all directed to make sure that we can engage with you on a regular basis. So now I think to get back to the Secretary's two main points today of updating you all on the issues she talked about is Ted Bromley. So thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Deputy. Thank you, Secretary Merrill. Okay, so we have we really have two things to go over today, and then I have a couple of comments at the end. But we'll first talk about what the Secretary was mentioning about the recent EO that the Governor issued regarding both primary and nominating petitions. So as the Secretary said, there was recent litigation both over nominating petitions and primary petitions, both in state and federal court, against various states, including Connecticut. And so the Governor went ahead and addressed these issues by an executive order. And here's basically what we need to know about the executive order. So in terms of a primary petition, which is what the registrars most generally have to deal with, the primary petition will be the application will be the same. So for a local registrar of voters or a single town state rep, the primary petitions will be applied for and received from the local registrars of voters. Any multi-town district office primary petition, and that includes any statewide candidate, Congress, state Senate, and half of the state rep races, those will be applied for and received from the Secretary of State's office. So the application will be the same. The only difference is that the application can be submitted to either you or our office electronically. So somebody can email that that request for a primary petition as opposed to having to appear in person for obvious reasons. So once the primary petitions, oh, and I should say, and then when you issue the primary petitions, you can issue them either in hard copy through the U.S. mail, or you can issue them electronically by email, depending upon the choice of the applicant. Once the applicant has the primary petitions, they're able to do a couple of different things that they ordinarily would not have been able to do if we were not under this COVID virus pandemic. So what they are able to do is they're able to circulate the primary petition electronically as well. But it doesn't go so far as to do some type of DocuSign or some type of fancy electronic signature. It's more old school than that. And what it allows the individuals to do is to, let's say that I wanted Secretary Merrill to sign my primary petition. I could email her a copy of it. She could download it, sign it, scan it, and send it back to me. Or if she had the ability to sign her signature on her computer, like many of us do nowadays, with a finger, a stylus, or something of that nature, she could also do that and send it back. But what she isn't able to do is sort of the DocuSign format, where somebody just either types in their initials or types in their name, and then as opposed to a signature format, it appears as just a typed signature. The EO does not go that far. So they can circulate them electronically, and they can be returned by the signers electronically. The candidate will actually gather those pages that he or she is circulating, and then they can either drop those signature pages in the mail to you, or they can scan them and email them back to you in one PDF document. That was important to us because we did not want to have you, as local officials, try to track down, you know, several pages coming in at emails at various different times. The only other thing that is slightly different about this is that an individual, and this comes right out of the EO because of obvious social distancing requirements, is that if an individual is the only person signing that page, so I email a page to Secretary Merrill, she signs it, and she emails it back to us, the circulator statements on the back do not need to be completed because I guess the EO is assuming that, that given that Secretary Merrill is the only person that signed it, that that you know she was the circulator, so to speak. So be on the lookout for that. But if a primary petition has several pages or several signatures, rather, I'm sorry, on it, more than one, then the full complement of certifications on the back of the primary petition need to be executed. Now, if you're trying to take notes down furiously on this, our office worked extensively with the Attorney General's office on putting together a 3-page plain language summary of what I just told you, and it's available on our website, and I also emailed it out to everybody. So if you have additional questions after reading it, certainly reach out to us, but I think we did a pretty good job of laying out the exact steps of how to do it. The only other difference in the primary petition is that the governor also reduced the signature requirement from 5% to 3.5%. And if for some reason you are confused about how to do the math on that, there is a spreadsheet on our website in the same spot that you would find this plain language summary that calculates all of the districts for you and calculates both the 5% and the 3.5% as a comparison. So it's right there. So you don't even have to do the math. So once the circulator submits the petitions back to the local registrar of voters, then you would check the signatures as you ordinarily would do. You would check to make sure that individual is a properly enrolled party member in the appropriate district, and if they are, you would count that signature. If they're not, then you would reject that signature, and then you would either pass those results on to your local town clerk, or we would pass those results you would pass those results on to us so we can figure out if they made the signature requirement on a multi-town district, same as they would have in the past. So for the town clerks on the call, there is a very similar, almost mirrored update for nominating petitions. So the nominating petitions, the application still starts with us. There is still a requirement that the town clerks actually verify the applicant's name as compared to the registry list. However, that can be done electronically with you. So again, the application can be circulated around electronically. You can verify that the individual's name is as appropriate on the registry list. You can return that to them, and they can return it to us. So the petition is the same, or I'm sorry, the application is the same. However, it can also be circulated electronically. Once we issue the nominating petitions, again, there's a couple of different things. We will issue them either in hard copy or electronically, depending upon how the candidate wants it. The signature requirement was reduced by 30% down to 0.70% as opposed to 1%. But again, we figure that out. You don't have to worry about that. And again, the petitions themselves can be circulated electronically in the same manner as I described for the primary petitions, meaning they can be emailed back and forth. They can be sent through the U.S. mail, those types of ways to circulate the petitions. Again, the signer can sign them in either hard copy and scan it back, or they can sign with a stylus or their finger on a computer, et cetera, the same thing as the primary petition. And again, the candidate has to be responsible for collecting these pages and then either submitting them to our office or to the local town clerk's office in one PDF packet so as to not cause confusion or have any of the pages lost in email. Again, same procedure applies to the back of the nominating petition page, meaning that if it's only a single signer, they do not have to complete the back, but if there's more than one signature on the front, then they would have to complete the back. And then again, once those electronic pages are coming in, either the town clerk or the registrar of voters, depending upon how you do it locally with your nominating petitions, would check those pages, verify that the individual who has signed it, in this case, is an elector, and then you would send those results on to our office so we could tabulate the district as a whole, and then we would let you know if that individual has obtained ballot access as we normally do. So if you think about what the governor has done with this, he's trying to accommodate the fact that there is a great need for social distancing, trying to recognize the fact that it is very difficult, if not impossible, for individuals to walk around shopping malls, supermarkets, door-to-door, and circulate those petitions. So anywhere where there would have been human contact, there is an option for that to be an electronic contact of some way. So we'll take some questions on that in a minute. But so those are the two changes to the petitions. And again, the plain language summary as a law, and in addition to the signature requirements and the applications, are all posted on our website under the candidate section of how do I get on the ballot under petitioning. And I also sent those out to you as well. So the second thing that we wanted to talk about was the absentee ballot opinion. And I know that we've talked about this a little bit, but we put together an opinion whereby a pre-existing illness actually qualifies as an illness for absentee balloting purposes. And what that means is that the Centers for Disease Control have come out with many, many pre-existing illnesses that if that individual was also to obtain the COVID virus would have a very difficult time with the virus and in some cases a very difficult time even surviving. And so with that in mind, the opinion basically says that, you know, again, we'll use the example of diabetes. If you have diabetes, you have an illness. You really do. There's no question about that. In a non-COVID environment, that illness might not prevent you from going to the polls. You may be even able to run a marathon or do a construction job or some other rigorous work. But it still is an illness. And for the COVID-19 environment, that illness certainly is preventing you from appearing in person at your polling place. And so basically the opinion is as simple as that. We've defined or further defined, the secretary has, the meaning of illness, and certainly an underlying illness of diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, asthma, high blood sugar, high blood pressure, autoimmune diseases, any of those types of things, cancer treatments, all of those types of things would qualify as pre-existing illnesses that would enable somebody to vote by absentee ballot, checking the box illness, because indeed, one, it is an illness, and two, in this COVID environment, it certainly is preventing that individual from going to the polls. So we did send that out, so we can take some questions on that in a minute as well. So the last two things that I just wanted to touch briefly on is, one is that I got a few emails and a reminder email from Tim in Waterbury that we do realize that many of our emails before some of these executive orders have gone out have certain dates in them that are now not correct. For instance, and what I forgot to say about the primary nominating petitions is that in that same EO, the governor gave the petitioners two extra days. So in our original email, it might have said, you know, August 5th as a deadline, but with the EO now, it's really August 7th. And we do know that. In fact, sometimes what we like to do is to highlight those changes. So I know at least for the primary petitions, the original mailing went out with one date, set of dates in it, and a second mailing went out where I highlighted and read the changes. So we do know that. We will do the same for our statewide election calendar, highlighting some of those changes that have been made. But it's also good to have the original underlying documents because, 15 years from now, if and when we have another pandemic like this, it's always good to be able to see how those changes relate to what we did. So we will be updating those as we go. So thank you for that reminder, Tim. And the last thing is a lot of questions about polling place consolidation. And this is something that we are actually still working on. I'm still working on with the secretary. I'm still working on with the COVID response committees. We will be offering some type of guidance in that in the very near future, rest assured. But it is not going to be a carte blanche. It is going to be a very controlled, rational decision-making process that is going to involve our office. So just be on the lookout for that. We are aware that you're asking for it. It's just it is actually more of a complex issue than it might seem when you say it fast. And so we do need to hammer out the details before we give out any sort of advice or instruction on that particular piece. So with that, I think that we are in a good spot to ask to answer some questions. So if anybody has some questions, if we could open that up, operator, that would be great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. At this time, if anyone would like to ask a question, please ensure that your phone is unmuted, press star 1, and please record your name clearly when prompted. If you do need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment, please, while we wait for questions. Our first question is from Tim Beeble. You may go ahead.
Okay, I think I'm unmuted. Yes, I had a couple of questions. With regard to the conventions, is there any change to the threshold of 15% of the convention vote in order to qualify for the primary?
There has not been a change to the 15% threshold, no.
Okay, and thank you. And second item is, will the clearinghouse, when they're mailing out absentee ballot applications, will they be enclosed in an envelope that have the local registrar of voters on the return address and also have the envelope marked return service?
It will be the absentee ballot applications, the return address would be the town clerk, not the local registrar of the voters. And in terms of the return address service requested, we're still actually looking at that issue, whether or not it would be better for those to be returned so that we know that if the address is not valid or whether or not we should forward that on to an address that is unknown to the local registrar of voters at the point. So we are actively investigating that one right now.
Right. Having it returned to the town clerk is fine. We just wanted to be notified if someone's not living at the address that is shown in CVRS. And I wouldn't want to see applications forwarded to Ohio or whatever other state they may have moved to. And one last thing. So then the primary petitions won't require the notarization?
Right. If it is circulated and signed by only one person, it will not. If it is signed by more than one person on the front, it will.
Okay. So not only sign the certification, but then they'll need a notarization as well. Okay. Thank you. That's it. Thank you, Ted.
Okay. You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Kim DiCarlo. You may go ahead.
Madam, so got a name change, no big deal. Ted, on this primary petition access guidance, I was listening to everything that was said today. So my understanding is if I'm running as a municipal state representative candidate or registrar of voters, I can get the form and submit it to, electronically. Is that correct?
Right. You mean the application?
Right. Because right now, the way it's currently set up, if you click on the link, it brings you to the Secretary's website. There is the form right now for U.S. Congress. There's a form for district, state rep, and state senate. And there's nothing for municipal candidates. And some of the conventions are starting today. So I didn't
right.
know if
yeah. –
yeah, go ahead.
Yes, they can use the same forms. We haven't historically issued a form ever for a municipal office, but should an individual actually use one of those, it's absolutely fine. And in fact, I want to say, I thought we made one of them. I'm just looking
because
now.
if you look at it, the very first thing, it says the candidate must complete the application for primary petition. The application can be located here. Then if you go down
right.
to number three, all multi-town district office primary petitions shall be submitted to Secretary of State. All single-town state representative primary petition requests shall be submitted to the registrar of voters of the party and the municipality. But if I don't know if I'm a first-time candidate or whatever, first-time dealing with the registrar's office, when I click on that link, it's bringing me to your page where the form I'm looking for isn't there. So I just see a little bit of confusion, maybe rewording number three, even just stating that to contact the local registrar so that, the candidate isn't actually running around looking for something that's not there.
Right. Yeah, I think we'll reword the link because if you look at the district primary petition page, it says important information, this application can be used for a single town state rep and it's filed with the registrar of voters, et cetera. So
okay.
we'll just reword it to make it a little more clear.
Okay.
But thank you.
All right.
Thank you. The next question is from Stacy Gravine. You may go ahead.
Hi, Ted. It's Stacy from East Haven. I have a question concerning, is the Secretary of State's office still going to be sending out the absentee ballots, or do each town have to start worrying about how many we should have printed up?
So we are enlisting the help of a mail house for the town clerks to manage the absentee ballot process. So the mail house is going to actually issue the absentee ballots, bundle them for the various towns, etc. But the towns will ultimately be responsible for working with Adkins or LHS, whomever you use, to actually order the ballots. And then Adkins and LHS will also work with the mail house to make sure that the appropriate materials get to them. So, yes, you still need to be involved in that process.
Okay. So I wasn't sure about that. I was a little fuzzy on that. Okay. Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Mary. You may go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me? Hello. This is Mary.
Hi, yep.
Oh, you can hear me. Okay, good. I am Mary from Canaan/Falls Village and was told by my registrars of voters that I'm one of 19 towns, town clerks, that has not linked my town clerk computers to the registrar of voters. I'm wondering, is there a resource to help me get this done? Or, because they said the importance of it is, yes, the Secretary of State is mailing out absentee ballot applications to everyone, but if I start to issue absentee ballots and get them back. I'm supposed to be getting this all registered on CBRS, so the Secretary of State can ballots are issued and back. Is this all correct?
Yep, that is correct. And we do have a resource. If you shoot me an email, I can hook you up with Steve Mason, who has been working with the towns to help those that are remaining get hooked up to centralized voter reg.
Thank you so much. That's all I needed to know.
Thank you. Our next question is from Hazel Gorman. You may go ahead.
Hi, Hazel Gorman from Ledger. I have two questions, Ted. First one is, do we need to contact the National Guard for a date and a time, or will we get some information relevant to that? And my second question is, when we receive the signatures back, do we still need to send them a receipt for the pages sent?
Okay, so two good questions. So the National Guard program of the safety, the cybersecurity process, that will be rolled out, and we will make contact with you on that in the future. I don't think we're in a position right now to start making appointments on that. So just stand by on that portion of it. In terms of the receipt, yes, it would be beneficial, I think, to everybody involved, given the fact that we're doing this electronically, people are submitting electronically, that we continue to do the receipts so that there is proof, particularly for you on your end, that you've received a certain amount of pages and that you've accounted for them electronically, so that the candidate will know if, you know, an email message got lost or something of that nature. So yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. The next question is from Karen Lyons. You may go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. One question, first one is, are we going to require that voters coming to the polling place wear a mask for the protection of our poll workers? And if they do not have a mask, can we require that they go and get one? Or do we have to provide them? Also, if you go on question on Google, Connecticut primary, August 11th, it says that the Secretary of State says that there will be same-day voter registration. I just wanted to touch base on that, but the PPE is as we're ordering it. Thank you.
So the first question about the mask. So right now, everybody is under the order right now from the governor to wear face masks whenever they're in the public. So I think that we will have to see as we get closer to April whether or not any of that is rolled back or not by the executive orders. So right now, I can't definitively say whether or not we could order somebody to do it because I don't know the state of the executive orders that are going to be in play. You know, we're in the middle of May. We've got June, July before we even get to August. In terms of the and Karen, what were the other two questions? I'm sorry.
No, it was just an information piece that if you go onto Google for the primary, it is stating that the secretary says there'll be same day voter registration.
Oh, okay. Thank you. All right. I'll have somebody reach out to Google so we can correct that. Thank you.
That's all. Thank you very much for all you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Vicki Urbowitz. You may go ahead.
Hi there. Questions I had was, so we might possibly have actually two primaries. My understanding is correct for August 11th. So if the mailing house is going to be sending out the applications, are they going to actually request two different ballots? And my second question is whether or not we're required to use the mailing house and if we could possibly hire somebody else in-house and then charge the state for the additional expense on that part. And that's it.
So the first is that one application will work for, and if you're one of those 20 to 30 towns that have a dual primary, meaning both a presidential preference primary and then a state rep or state senate primary. One application will suffice for both primaries, and in fact, both primaries will be on the same ballot. In terms of the taking part in the mail house, Deputy, do you have any insight on that one?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's an interesting question. I can say that it's going to be a lot easier for everyone involved if there's one set of hands in this instead of 3 or 5 or 15, and we can ensure quality control with a firm that you know, has done it before on scale. And ultimately, these are federal funds that we're using that our office has to report back to the state and the federal government on how we use it. So it's a good question, but for now, I think that our working assumption from the beginning is easier to manage the whole process by having one firm accountable to us in the implementation of all of this. But, you know, we'll take that under advisement as we get closer, but it's just going to be my top line read on that is it's going to be a lot easier, and we're the ones that ultimately have to be accountable on this as well. So there's not an opt out on this. We're going to get a good price for everybody by having the price for you is nothing, but the only way we're able to do that is if we go in bulk together. So I'm talking it through as we're going, but I think you see where our thinking is on this. But happy to keep talking with you about that.
Thank you.
Bet.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lisa Copps. Ma'am, your line is now open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Ted. A few questions. One is pretty simple. The ABS ballots, when they get returned to us, are the envelopes self-stick to protect the people, poll workers opening them? Can they be?
So that is one of the things. Right. So let me just take one question at a time because I tend to forget them if you ask them too many of them at once. So that's one of the things we are exploring with the mailhouse. Of course, I did send out the CDC information that says that they don't perceive that to be a heightened risk at all in terms of licking an envelope. But that is something we are exploring with the mailhouse to see if that's a product that they can provide in that mass of a quantity.
Okay. And my second question. Regarding the Safe Polls Plan and poll workers, we can give names of our poll workers who will probably work. If we ask them today if they would work, it's kind of hard to answer what August will be like. You guys are aware of that when we're giving you our information, that if somehow with opening everything up in the cities and towns, that the virus could get worse again, may change the poll workers' answers by the time August comes around. Right?
Right. So, okay. Right, exactly. So go ahead, Deputy.
Yeah, thanks. No, that's for sure. And I think this is just a good faith effort on everybody's part to try to figure out what the needs may be.
Okay.
And, you know, we understand that it might change or somebody might, you know, reconsider a week ahead of time, but it's important for all of us to not be just spitballing it and say, geez, none of my poll workers are going to show up. I need to consolidate from 15 sites to one. That's what they did in Wisconsin, and that didn't work well. So this is a good way to, you know, you're the best ones to have conversations with the folks that you work with. That's moderators, poll workers, and get their sense of it and give us the best estimate that you have. Then that helps us understand how many people that we might need to, you know, help recruit. And we're already in conversations with the state has an effort at getting volunteers for all kinds of COVID-related response. we're plugging into that network, and we're going to be able to use that network to help recruit people. Now, ultimately, you know, these are folks that you're going to have to either want and or vet as well, that you'll say, yep, great, you can. So it's, that part's still in your hands. We're just trying to figure out the scope and the scale of how many folks that we might need. It also helps inform us about consolidations as well.
Okay, thank you. And I have one more question, probably the biggest. Regarding the ABS ballot opinion, how does mental health fit in? People who are so anxious about getting the virus that they can't get themselves out the door to vote?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think that certainly would be one that would fall under illness as well, just as it would ordinarily. You know, if you have a social anxiety disorder where you wake up on election day morning and just can't get yourself out of the house, you know, I think you would be, you know, that would be a perfectly acceptable use of an absentee ballot. And so I think such is the case. And I actually even think I read somewhere where there is some type of COVID anxiety disorder that's been diagnosed. So, yes. So that would be one that you could check the illness as well.
Okay. Thank you both. And thank you. I repeat, echo, thank you for everything you're doing.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Andrew. So your line is now open.
Hello, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Not too well. Why don't you speak into the speaker? That'd be helpful.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Any better?
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah, I have a question about the primary petitions. I guess the last day for registrars receiving them, and I didn't introduce myself on the registrar question. Is, I guess now it's June 11th. The question, normally we're required to be in our office from 1 to 4 p.m. on that date. Is that still going to be a requirement now from what's being done electronically? Hello?
Well, I can still hear you. I don't know what happened to Ted. Ted, are you there?
Oh, geez, I'm sorry. My phone was on mute. I apologize. I put it on mute between questions. That's a great question. So right now, the requirement that the registrars be in their offices on the deadline day is not something, the statute still exists. It's not something that has been overturned by any executive order. And at this point, I think if things keep proceeding as they are, I think it's probably a requirement that should be in place. Maybe not both registrars, maybe just one, or maybe the registrars in shift. One goes in for 2 hours, the other one comes in for the other 2 hours or something to cover the office, because there still might be that offhand where somebody tries to submit primary petitions, or there could be a last-minute problem or something. But it's also something that, you know, that we're willing to work on as a staff as that deadline gets closer to see if the environment and things have changed. So, unfortunately, that's the best answer I think I can give you at this point.
Well, my second question, and it's going to be related to what you said, is a consent form. Has the process been defined for that? Or normally we would not be issuing a petition to someone unless we have received a consent form, which is one of the reasons that in the past both registrars have had to be in their office, because someone at the last minute would show up from, say, our town, who's been tasked to go out in another town and circulate a petition, but we have to sign that form for them, just certifying that they are, you know, a registered with that particular party in our town, or they can go out and circulate in another town. So I guess basically my question is, what about the consent form part of the process? Has that all been worked out?
Well, again, so remember, the consent form on the back, if you're talking about the back of the primary petition page, only needs to be executed if more than one person is intending to sign it on the front. So if this application is being emailed out to various people and only one signature is on the front, none of that stuff on the back, including the consent, the registrar's, the circulator's enrollment consent, needs to be completed.
No, I'm talking about what I think is specified in E619, where when you present with the candidate, the candidate or circulator comes in, and there has to be a consent form from the candidate before you can provide a petition. That's one step in the process, I believe. I may be wrong, but I thought that's where it started with. You couldn't just hand out a petition until a consent form from the candidate saying that, or a copy of one, I guess, saying that they haven't given their consent to run for this office.
Right. So that still does exist. And again, the application, the primary petition application, at least the one on our website, if a candidate decides to use it, includes on the bottom of it a candidate consent. Now, if they don't want to use that one and they want to do their own, as many candidates have done in the past, they can just write a simple letter that says, I want a primary petition, I consent to be on the ballot. That can be submitted to you electronically if the candidate so desires.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Barbara Putnam. Ma'am, your line is now open.
Hi, I have a question about people who don't want to come into the polls because they are living with someone who has a compromised immune system. Would they be allowed to use an absentee ballot?
So individual who is simply not wanting to come to the polls because of the fear of the COVID, that would go beyond our petition. And it's something that would have to be dealt with by an executive order through the governor's office. Denise, or secretary or deputy, you want to say anything else on that?
Well, just that we may not have seen, the full story yet. Secretary Merrill came out with her guidance and took it within her legal responsibilities. But the fact is that the governor also has certain powers, and the legislature might be back as well. So all of us are going to have to stay tuned to those kind of concerns that you're raising are very valid, but we've gone to within the legal authority that the secretary has, so it may be up to others to address it further. Is that fair to say?
Okay.
Yes, that's just yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kathy Grace. Ma'am, your line is now open.
Hi. No, thank you. My question has already been asked by Karen and answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Giselle Hartford. Ma'am, your line is now open.
Hi, everyone. Two quick questions. The mailing of petitions from the candidates, if, because we do have the June deadline piece, if they mail the petitions in and they come in after, are we still going by the guidelines of the postage? And if it's postage after the 11th, you know, we reject them. How do you want to deal with that one? And then my other question is in regards to the absentee ballots for college students. We have was brought to my attention by a Trinity student. Their addresses that they have on the actual CVRS are 300 Summit, which none of them are back in school to receive their mail. So how do they go about doing that piece? Any advice?
Okay. So the first is the deadline for the petitions is still the deadline for the petitions, 4 o'clock on the appointed day. So if it's sent by mail, it would have to be received just as it normally would if it was sent by mail in any other year by you by the deadline. If it's sent by email, then it would have to be received by 4 o'clock on the deadline. In terms of the college students, that's a great question. We're sort of working our way through that now. And the best I can say is that what we're going to do is we're going to recognize in those college towns, particularly and probably with your help, those mailing addresses that are associated with colleges so we can avoid that pitfall when we send out the applications. But we're also looking to enhance our voter lookup tool so that when an individual looks up themselves, it'll also give the residence and mailing addresses that we have on file for them, so that if indeed they need to make a change, they could contact the registrars to make that change as well, because right now when you look it up, it does not give the addresses, so we're going to add that. Obviously, addresses of victims of spousal abuse and those that their addresses can't be publicized won't be, you won't be able to find it on our voter lookup tool, but for those that are, as long as they put in their identifying information, name, date of birth, et cetera, they'll be able to view their address to verify that it's correct as well. So those are some of the things that we're trying to do to sort of alleviate some of those concerns.
Okay. So as far as the mailing piece of the petition, can you put that in writing to us only so if we do have a challenge, we know that we have that we could show the folks you sent
yes,
us the stuff
absolutely.
That didn't arrive on time? And this is why we cannot process it?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Renee Waldron. Ma'am, your line is now open.
Hi. Calling about the emergency plan, I think, Deputy Bates, you mentioned that this could be as easy as a phone call. And is that accurate?
So you should have an emergency plan. If you don't, we're happy to talk with you about how you can create one. There are templates. And what I'm referring to about the phone call is the conversation about the Safe Polls plan overall. So an emergency plan is part of that. But it's also if you have questions about, gee, we have 10 polling sites and we're thinking about closing 9. And then we can talk about what kind of metrics might be useful in that. For example, for a primary, it makes a bit more sense to be able to close some, but in a general election, not so much. Or why are you doing that? Is it because that you don't think you have poll workers? Have you talked to how many poll workers you might have? So that kind of thing. It's essentially this is an iterative process. If you have any questions about the Safe Poll plans, you've had that now for 2 weeks, I think, in your inbox that Ted sent out. Please do call us and we can help talk you through it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Betsy McAllister. Ma'am, your line is now open.
This afternoon, before those two guys got there.
Uh-huh. Hello, Betsy. Your line is now open.
I gotta take this.
Yeah.
Hi there. I might have missed this question, but it's regarding the the notice that we have to put in the paper about candidates being filed. Since state rep and state senate candidates do not get sent to our, they're not certified in our office. They're certified in the state secretary of state's office. Why are we? You know, how would we know that they were delivered to you? Are you going to have a way of notifying town clerks that you've received them in a timely manner? Also, we understand that we don't have to put things in the newspaper. We can just post on our website, which is saving towns lots of money. I hope that gets changed legislatively permanently. So those two things. But the main thing is about party endorsements for the state offices. And obviously registrars and justice of the peace will be certified with the town level, not the state level. Correct.
Right. So yes, you can post the notices on your website. That's correct. The notice that you're putting in the paper is simply a notice that is telling individuals that if they're interested in those multi-town districts that they come to our office. That's been in place now for, I don't know, at least three or four state elections. So that's probably, I don't know, 12 years, something of that nature. But it's been there for a while. And so all you're doing in addition, so we sent the sample notice out and it says that if you're looking for those lists, go to the Secretary of State. That's how they, when they made the change and made a lot of the filing done with us, that's how the legislature changed that notice requirement in the statute. And yes, Registrar of Voters is actually filed with our office. Justice of the Peace is filed locally with the town clerk.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Robert Ike. So your line is now open.
Yes, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, my question is about the high school registration. Will there be an executive order or waiver of the general statute requiring high school registration given that schools are closed?
Well, I think given that the schools are closed, it's impossible for you to actually do it. So it's one of those statutes, just like the supervised balloting, where the executive order really isn't necessary because of the fact that you can't possibly do it. So we will make sure and send that to you in writing so that there's no question about that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. I think we'll do one more to leave some time for closing remarks for the deputy and the secretary.
Thank you. Our last question comes from Al. Would you say your line is now open?
I have a couple of questions regarding staffing. Are we required to have assistant registrars at the polls? Because in one place it says we do not, you can have them, but it's not necessary, number one. And also, it's not necessary to have AB counters. You can have them, but it's not necessary. I mean, without the AB counters, who's going to be doing the counting? And without the assistant registrars at the polls, who's going to certify the list at the end of the day?
So good question. So the advantage that we have with most of the towns having simply a presidential preference primary is that we're governed by the presidential preference primary staffing polling rules, which say that the maximum number that you need is only three. And of those three, they can cover various duties. So that's why the instructions say you can have an assistant registrar, but you don't need one because maybe your ballot clerk is also the assistant registrar. And so on and so forth. So yes, a lot of those positions are optional because we're operating under the presidential preference primary staffing rules, which allow you great latitude in terms of your poll workers. However, if you find that you think that you're going to need some absentee ballot counters, then you can certainly go ahead and hire them. It allows you greater latitude in your staffing.
Okay, that was one question. The other question I have is with sanitation supplies. Am I to understand that we're supposed to order those through you, through the state, or do we get them from our other resources, our own resources?
Right. So what we're doing is we're finding vendors. We're working with ours and town clerks, and we're finding some vendors, many of whom offer a kit that they will send to you, which offer PPE supplies for a polling place, mask, gloves, hand sanitizer, et cetera. And I think they, in most of the kits, it's upwards of, I think they give enough for like 10 to 15 poll workers.
Yeah, okay.
For a polling place.
My counterpart found that. She looked it up and she found it all. I mean, we order it or do we order it through you?
So what we're doing is we're looking to see if it's cost effective for us to be able to just order it for the entire state as opposed to having to reimburse each town for the purchase. Okay. So we will know that in the next day or so, and we will make that announcement to you. But I believe that we are leaning towards purchasing those for the towns to make it easier so that we don't have to worry about the towns ordering their own supplies and trying to reimburse them for it.
Okay, that's great. Okay, then the last question I have, am I also to understand that the National Guard will be sent to our polling places to maintain social distancing in line? or is that something
Let's clarify that one. No, the National Guard is they have a cybersecurity task force.
Okay.
That enables them to assist towns looking at whether or not they have weaknesses in their computer systems and can be hacked.
Okay.
No, we are not sending the National Guard to the polling places.
Okay. I was just confused about that. It just sounded to me like that's what was happening, but thanks for the clarification.
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to need to maintain polling distances, social distancing at the polls ourselves, right?
Well, and we're going to issue some guidance on that, and we are looking at the guidance that the supermarkets use. Because I think that works very well. So we're going to sort of model our guidance after something like that.
Okay. Thank you very much. You've answered all my questions.
Okay. So, Secretary or Deputy, do you have any closing remarks before we sign off here?
Yeah, I think the Secretary might. I just wanted to go back to the question with the ABs and guidance. And I think that one thing that the Secretary has also put in her overall plan is that there'll be a public information campaign, because all of you as local officials certainly will get asked questions by friends, family, citizens on this topic. And the Secretary in this office will be putting out information to the public to help clarify things, and we'll certainly include anything that the legislature might do or the governor might do in between now and then. So we've got some time to work together on that one. But thank you for your questions today, and Madam Secretary.
Yes, thanks. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. I don't know about you, but I always learn a lot about, you know, what's going on from the questions that people ask. So I hope we're slowly trying to understand what we have to do here. I'm very confident that we have a good plan. It's well thought out. I just want to reiterate for people, it's really important that you get your plans in so that we have an ample time for doing things like helping you hire poll workers, getting the PPE, and all the various things that we're going to try to use our resources to help you. So the sooner the better. We will have more guidance on some of the things like the, you know, moving of polling places and that sort of thing. We're going to look very carefully at that because, you know, as I've said before, when you saw those pictures in Milwaukee of what happened when they collapsed too many polling places, that's the last thing we want. But we also want to make sure that we have the right number of staffing and polling places, absentee ballot resources. And it's very, very tricky because we just don't know. We've got to calculate human behavior, and you just never know how this is going to play out. So we're going to try to be ready for anything and keep the questions coming. I think we all learn a lot. You know, the question today about what we do about students, for example, who are not at the campuses where they're registered, we had already thought about that because I used to represent the little town of Storrs. And so I'm very conscious of how we're going to have to work probably with the universities to try to locate these people and try to get to them and make them understand they need to re-register at home if that's where they are. So things like that are really important for us to hear about. So keep them coming, and we'll keep trying to let you know every time something important happens. Thank you very much, everyone, and I think we'll close out now. So thank you, Ted. Thank you, Scott. And we'll probably be in touch in the next week or so, information comes out.